Shalom and welcome again to another edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast and TV arm of Jewish Sacred Aging. And I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address. Thank you very, very much for being with us. These podcasts, as you know, are designed to help explore some of the issues that touch us, our families, and our communities in light of the ongoing revolution in longevity that is reshaping much of our Jewish world. And we appreciate your support. You can follow us at JewishSacredAging.com, the homepage, or like us at the Jewish Sacred Aging Facebook page. And it is with a great deal of pleasure that we welcome to the Seekers of Meaning program today, Ellen Rithberg, who is the author of a very, very interesting recently published book called Why is Grandma Naked? Subtitled, in case you get very excited, Caring for Your Aging Parent. So Ellen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Yeah.
our pleasure. You're coming to us from beautiful Brooklyn. So thank you for joining us. Okay, why is Grandma naked? We won't even go into the fact that why isn't Grandpa naked, thank God. But this is a very, very interesting book available at the usual places, including, I'm sure, the great God Amazon. As many of these books that we've highlighted on Jewish Sacred Aging, this comes from your own personal story, correct?
It does.
Yeah. And so in the beginning on page IX, you really talk about the fact that the genesis of this book flowed from the idea of caring for a declining loved one. Talk to me about, if you can, when did you realize what was going on and
certainly
that you really had to write a book about this journey?
Yeah. Well, there were things that I didn't know, which oddly enough, I'm an attorney who for many years represented senior citizens and even wrote reports for judges and recommendations about guardianships. But I didn't remember that sometimes one of the first things that goes or declines or changes about a person as they age, if they are, they have some form of dementia, is their judgment. So what I found out was that mom was wanting to do things like change a light bulb, even though she had asked me right then and there, would I do it? And then she went for the stepladder and she was not very steady on her feet and she started to do it herself. And I didn't draw the connection, but that was probably the very first thing that I noticed. We also had a pact. She was driving. She was already in her early 90s. Mom, you can drive, but don't drive at night. I want you to be home at night. I had moved in with my mom to care for her, and she wasn't. So I'm a very good bounty hunter. I would call up the CVS, the pharmacy department. Is Mrs. Pober there? Oh, she just left. So I saw she, you know, that was a problem, that she couldn't have her boundaries, which she was a very dignified older woman. Those things started to decline and leave.
Yeah, you write a lot about in the book boundaries, not only for the person needing care, but for the caregiver, and you allude to the fact that this can be, and having walked this walk myself with my mom, the boundary issues are very, very fluid, but very, very personal, and sometimes can be flashpoints. But you also talk about when you need to ask for help. Yes. Well, that's really, 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 in a lot of the work we do at Jewish yeah. Sacred Aging, and we run across this a lot of times when we do the caregiving workshop. When do I ask for help? Talk to me about that part of the book.
Certainly. Well, I had moved in with mom after she had fallen. So she had an aide for when she was needing the ambulation stuff. But then that person went away. So mom was home during the day at the beginning, and there was nobody there to make her lunch, which she was able to do. But all of a sudden, I just realized I was gone, and I had a long commute, and I had a full-time job as an attorney. I got somebody in. We advertised in a local, there was a church that used to put out a call for people that did this kind of work, a companion. And we interviewed her in a local pizza store, and she just seemed to suit mom to a T. She drove. We lived in the suburbs where there was really no mass transportation. And right. She'd take mom to things like going sock shopping, which mom liked for some reason. This woman that used to read 3 books a week, she liked going sock shopping with this lady and hearing about this lady's life. Yeah.
So the idea of these constantly changing boundaries, especially when you're dealing with types of issues like you're alluding to with dementia and Alzheimer's, mm-hmm. boundaries can be very, very fluid. And talk to me, how quickly can these boundaries change?
Well, the thing is, they may be changing, but if they don't, they are not reflected in behaviors that you can recognize. For example, when my mom was more declined, I had no idea that all of her adding skills had gone. And when I took her to a neurologist, and the neurologist asked her, if I gave you a dollar or 100 pennies and I took away 13 of them, how many were left? And mom couldn't come up with that. Or at some point she didn't even know what her address was. I was like, whoa. So sometimes there's a gap in where they are, and there's a denial. In my case, I think there was a denial because my mother was such a high functioning, independent, early 90s lady.
No. I know exactly the type of woman you're talking about. I had, that was my mother, who up until she was 93, was very into it, and then dementia hit and everything changed. The title of your book, I have to ask you, why is Grandma Naked?
Okay.
talk to me about the use in the caregiving journey that you write about, the need to keep a sense of humor.
Okay, definitely. Well, actually, as a writer, I write humorous books and I write humorous essays. So, however, in my own life, I didn't always see the humor in real time. Like for the first time we were standing, I was standing, mom was sitting in her den. There's a very large picture window. Mom lived on a main street with two streets that were main streets. And she just started taking off her clothes. And, there's a disconnect only for a minute because you close the curtains and she had an aide at that point. But we all had a hearty laugh, and it really wasn't at her. It's just, it's almost like a nervous laugh. But, after the fact, it's comparing the person who was to the person that she'd become. There is a funny thing. Or mom had delusions about people that were really quite harmless. Like, she was totally obsessed with the Progressive insurance lady on the commercial. And she made up this, if you'd like, I'd just tell you briefly, she had this whole like thing she believed about the woman, that the woman was pregnant. And why did the producer make her wear white? Because white usually shows off weight and doesn't make you look thinner. And my son Matt Ritter, he's a stand-up comic. I don't know if it enters his and a screenwriter, but it may end up in one of his routines. She had something about the Trivago guy, and that he didn't take good, his grooming wasn't good. And suddenly, his grooming got better because the producer told him that he had to shape up. And I'm sure mom didn't read that somewhere. I think it just came from her own, florid imagination.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about as well is, because when we do our stuff on caregiving for aging, we will talk about that this is really a new life stage for the care and for the person needing care. This is a new life stage. In fact, you're calling the frail elderly the fourth stage of life as opposed to the third stage of life. But there are these moments in the caregiving journey you become profoundly aware, I think they're spiritual moments, of a real shift, in roles. Yes. Where in essence, you allude to this in I think one of the chapters. How did that, you were professional, you wrote books, you advised people legally. How did it feel when that first time you said, my God, I have to take care of my mother just as she took care of me when I was a child? That shift in roles, what did that feel like? What was that like for you?
It is uncomfortable. And I say my book is organized alphabetically, and my A chapter is Be the Alpha Dog. And all of a sudden, you have to be in charge. If you know that for example, it takes X number of minutes for your mom to timely or your dad to timely get to the bathroom, you've got to very, kind of firmly tell them, you have to go, and insist, because if you don't, and they still are at that stage where they still are continent, things are going to go downhill. So, you know, and they're going to want to do things. You're going to have to say no. And like many older people, people don't like being told what to do, whatever age they are. Far be it, you know, your own child. Yes, it's such a good observation, Rabbi. You know, it's hard.
Well, I want to pick up on this advocate thing, because one of the things I have found, not in person, but also professionally in teaching all this stuff, is once you enter what I call the system, whether it's assisted living or CCRC or nursing home or having to qualify for Medicare or what, once you enter the system, talk to me about this idea to expand upon, that you really need to be an advocate. And if you can't be, because not everybody has that personality, you need to find an advocate. Talk to me about how important that is.
Oh, gosh. I will give you one very good example that comes to mind. I don't think it made it into my book, but everybody that's listening to this podcast will hear it. I absolutely could not have that conversation with Mom about what if she became unconscious and wasn't able to say if she wanted her life to be, you know, in some way intervened biologically or, you know, by means that were not her own body. I couldn't have that conversation, even though I was extremely close to her, and we talked about lots of things. I had her in a program, I think it was a geriatric program that had a social worker. So I called the social worker. I said, I can't have this conversation with my mom. Could you come on over and have that conversation with her? She was not that declined, so she could, in fact, have a conversation about that. And my goodness, what a relief that was, you know? So that's one example. I mean, there's plenty of them when you realize you can't be there and the person can't fend for themselves. Mom couldn't even make lunch, so she couldn't do lots of things. And it's at a certain point, she was ready for 24/7 care, but also I wanted Mom to remain at home. So you then get involved with the whole aid process and what happens when there's a replacement aide and the replacement aides don't know sometimes what they're doing and all these things. Yeah.
There's so many subtleties about this, especially the hiring of the home health aide. And, yes. You know, how do you make sure that these people are qualified, trained, capable of picking somebody up if they fall and you're not there? Do you have any advice for people who may be entering this journey right now? And they say, well, we have to bring in somebody because I have to work. The kids are in school. My spouse is working. I need somebody here with dad at least 6 hours a day. But I don't know how to do that.
Yeah. Okay.
What advice do you have?
Okay. You have to be, even though your time is really strained and you're so tired. I know I used to flop onto my bed at 8 o'clock at night. I just had to be horizontal. I just had nothing left after I'd worked, cooked Mom dinner and watched Jeopardy and Wheel of Fortune with her. So that being said, I got in touch with our municipality. I knew they had some sort of service. One of them was they had a list of agencies that they thought were fairly decent and made it onto their list. And they gave me the names of those. And then I went and called several of them until one I thought, you know, was better. And I used that agency. So you might also find out that your municipality or some wonderful organization through Alzheimer's, any Alzheimer's group, that there's a program for the frail elderly, which I got Mom into, which was such a godsend. She was a quiet woman and rather shy, but she would always come out and become a different person when we went on cruises. So I knew she had this social side, and she used to go out and about shopping and doing things all day. And suddenly she was home, and I got her into this wonderful program that was so well run, with a hot lunch, which I say, and a hot snack, which may have been the selling point for her at that point. And they did a very in-depth interview of both me and her, and came to the house to see our house was safe. It was a wonderful thing, but that was just by not that I'm so wonderful. I figured out I had to do some research.
Well, I think that's really important. The idea that you have to do your research, or have somebody else help you do the research, because we're just totally nobody. There is no class in caregiving that we can take. This is very personal. And everybody does it differently because everybody is different. I mean, you have to tailor the caregiving to the personality. And you're right. It can be exhausting. It can be because you're paying not necessarily with money, but even as the Talmud says, you pay with time, the time that you have to devote. Following up on that, on this whole idea of being the advocate and really being present and doing the research, one of the chapters in your book talks about, it's called Know Your Parents, Doctors and Providers. You actually talk, it is really important for some people. When is it time to change doctors? Talk to me about that.
Oh, sure. I can just give you an example that happened before my mom, her cognitive abilities had declined, but I rarely went to the doctor with her. She was in her late 80s, but drove, as I say. And she had a doctor she was going to. And I met him for the first time for that normal routine exam. And he didn't look at my mom once the entire time. He just looked at me. And I felt the way he interacted with my mother and things that mom had told me about this particular doctor that she felt was made her uncomfortable. And then I looked on the chart. I wasn't really trying to see something. It was just right there. And there were three words on the chart: pale, obese, and old. And that was it. After we left the doctor, I said, Mom, if that's the way this doctor has reduced you to, he's reduced you to these three words, does he even care if you're alive or not? Really? And my mom was more than happy to change, but it was her decision at that point. So when to change doctors is, if you have, we'll use the Yiddish word, if you're seichel dick, if you have seichel, common sense, if there's something that you're seeing is not right, if there's something that's, something that was told to your parent if they're going to the doctor alone, or you're told something that if you're going with your parent to the doctor and doesn't add up, there's no right or wrong way. I can only, and I don't give advice in my book. I just say, this is the way I did it. It worked for me and with God's, and I do say with God's help, mom died peacefully at home, which is what I so wanted for her. I just didn't want her in a nursing home. And I knew since I was in the picture that we could see it through with all the things that were in place and everything. So
hovering over a lot of these conversations is this concept of dignity. And this is especially profound in people with Alzheimer's, dementia, as they go through this stage. And I'm sure you had this conversation with yourself and perhaps your family about, the idea of dignity. You did this professionally as a lawyer. You did this personally with your mom. Talk to me how you felt, if you had any of these conversations with your mom about dignity, really what that meant to her, but equally, what did it mean to you?
Okay. That's a wonderful question. I always try to deal with mom with respect for the person she was at that point in time, respect for the person she'd always been, her core personhood, and a parent. And I don't have to tell you, Rabbi, honor your parent. How do you honor your parent? You love them and you treat them with that dignity. So I think how I did it, I'm not really sure. It was my attitude, I think, and my respect for my mom that my closest friend said to me, your kids, they so admire you for what you did. And in our society, it shouldn't be that way. It should be a natural thing that everybody does. But some people just can't see it through to do that. And I do understand that. They don't have what they say in Yiddish. They don't have the kishkas for it. You really need the kishkas to want to do it, which is why often there's one sibling who's able to be that primary person, to be with that parent, make most of the decisions, have another sibling if they're fortunate, as I was, to have a sister as a sounding board who had good common sense, who I could vent to sometimes. Another sister did other things. She helped build a ramp. She did other things. She kept in contact with mom. But it really, there's going to be one person. That's the one thing that I've seen generally who's, in that driver's seat. And dignity is just, it's something that isn't always conveyed in words or even saying, I have this attitude. It's just being the daughter or the son that, or, you know, relative that you are, because I know some people are taking care of aunts and uncles and even cousins sometimes.
No, I that's why I wanted to ask you that question, because the dignity is also very, very personal and also changes. What I may feel is what I sense my own dignity at age 50 may be very, very different when I'm 90, depending upon a whole series of conversations. And you do talk about, I mean, it was my favorite chapter only as a baseball fan, the designated hitter chapter. But that really is the one person in the family who, and it usually is from the family of origin and how people were assigned roles as you were growing up. And as you're correct to point out, proximity to the person needing care does not necessarily mean that you're the designated caregiver. I mean, this is, we've seen this a lot. Which leads me to a question of how important it is in your experience, both personally and professionally, for a family not only to have a conversation about end of life issues, but really at a certain point to have a conversation about developing as a somebody who was on one of the podcasts earlier, a care plan, and saying, look, if we need to develop this, let's decide now who is going to, what responsibilities are going to do this. Can you do this? Or a sister may turn around and say, look, I love, but I can't do, I just don't have, as you say, the kishkas to do this. I will help this way. How important is it to have that conversation about it, developing a care plan, in your opinion?
If you can do it, frankly, I didn't have a care plan. I do remember there was a point, you know, there were so many things to do, so many things to do. I called my sister, Roberta, up and I said, there's this medical bill that, you know, it's an erroneous charge. Please take care of it. I just can't do it. And she did it. And, you know, it took like an hour and a half or more on the phone of her doing it. But I knew I couldn't do that. And part of how the care plan is formulated, which I think is more important, is recognizing, as you say, Rabbi, the fluidity of a situation, which can change radically because of, you know, something that happens to the person physically or cognitively all of a sudden.
Right.
Yeah.
How did you take care of yourself in the middle of this journey? Because self-care is...
Yeah.
you just answered the question.
Okay.
But looking backwards, I've always been...
Okay. I'll call myself for the moment. I used to be what's called a gym rat. I mean, when I say I'm a gym rat, I didn't spend a lot of time in the gym, but I always exercised. I mean, practically every single day without fail. But there were some days that, especially before I had anybody with mom, I felt I couldn't leave her alone. I would watch Wheel of Fortune with her and I just jog in place for like half an hour to an hour. And I didn't make much of a thumping noise. She had wall-to-wall carpeting. It didn't set her off, you know. I walked. I was a big walker. When I did manage to get to the gym at some point, it would be a stationary bicycle wedged in between work and, you know, and at a time when somebody was with mom. To my mind, that physical exercise thing, if you're fine physically and you get your doctor's okay, to me, it's just vital because although I don't think I suffer from depression, don't we all feel depressed about things when it comes to caregiving and our parents are changing and there's lots of things coming at us and the stresses, you know, and the weirdness, because there's weird things that happen. you have to get off your, you know, you got to sweat it out, right?
No. That's why I asked the question, because I tell people when I talk to them and they're entering this tunnel, as I call it, I said, you have to make sure, even though it's, you're going to fight it, you have to make sure you eat right, you exercise, you get out, you have to take some time for self-care, because if you get sick and you're the designated caregiver, you can't be present. That's if right. You're yourself, you know,
absolutely. Such a great thing. Also, if you're able to go out on excursions with your family member. I know at one point mom couldn't walk at all any distance. I took her to the orchid show at the Bronx, you know, at the New York Botanical Gardens. And boy, people are wonderful. They let you go. You have somebody in a wheelchair. Right, getting your own, that own, the person out is wonderful too for the fresh air, you know.
No, if it's that, absolutely. If and when it's possible. Again, we're talking with Ellen Ritberg, the author of Why Is Grandma Naked? subtitled Caring for Your Aging Parent, especially one beginning with cognitive decline. Ellen, the medical, I want to just come back before we start running out of time with the medical stuff. How important is it, as you begin to notice, let's say you notice a parent or a spouse, because there's something, you just feel that there's something starting. And you say, well, I'll go to my family doctor. Okay. How important is it to get a very good gerontological workup, a real, as soon as you start to think that something's going on, how important is that from your experience and perspective?
Okay. In my own experience, my mother had a cardiologist who was her primary care physician, and I really liked him. And one of the things he said to me early on when I first met him is, we want to keep mom out of the hospital, because if she goes into the hospital, she's not going to come out. And so there were other ways to keep her out of the hospital. So he enrolled her in a program that had a geriatric component that gave extra services with a nurse coming to the house and other people to call upon. And that was helpful. So although I didn't do a full geriatric workup, again, it's funny, it's such a personal journey. And even though I, you know, it was something that I did in my personal life, there's a lot of times, you know, your personal life and your professional life, there's a total disconnect. So I didn't say, oh, this is what I should do because I've seen other people do it. I wouldn't say I winged it, but when I felt I had the moving parts in place, and again, they move. So, you know, having that wonderful doctor in there was great. And she also went to another doctor for a kidney specialist. She absolutely adored him. And those two doctors were colleagues, and they would talk to each other and compare whether they could adjust something of mom's. And, you know, between those two doctors, I think mom was served very well. And the program that her cardiologist got her into.
Mm-hmm. So I also want to ask you a question, because many people experience this as caregivers, and they take over the finances of a loved one, and they're there, they monitor. One of the things that sometimes slips through the cracks is a lot of people have, as they move into this fourth stage of life, a ton of different prescriptions. How important is it for you as the caregiver to be able to talk to the pharmacist and say, does this pill that this doctor just prescribed get along with this pill that the other doctor prescribed? Do they all these pills get along with each other, or is it going to cause more chemical reaction within my loved one's body? How important is that?
Well, I will tell you this, even to the present time, even with my own life, there's at least one pharmacist in a pharmacy I go to regularly. I know that person's name. They really seem to give me very full and knowledgeable answers. And I ask questions. And I began doing that when I was a young mommy with my first child. I would call the pharmacist up. It was a local pharmacy. Now it's all chains. But even the chains have, you know, if you find that there's a pharmacist that you know and like. So, I felt that pharmacists were somebody that I could sometimes get information about. And, you know, again, a lot of caregivers today, we are ourselves seniors. So we know the pharmacist from dealing with them with our own prescriptions, if we have any, or anything we may have had, which might have been a transient condition.
No. The more information and the more acquisition, and that's part of being the advocate, by the way. I mean, it really is. That's why that's such an important thing, because not only medically in the system, but pharmacologically, you also have to be an advocate. This is why this is like a new, it's a life stage. It is all encompassing. So before we have to run out of time, what's, you walk this walk, you live this journey, you've written this book. What's the one absolutely rock bottom line piece of advice that you would give somebody if they walked into you and say, I'm beginning this journey, what should I look out for? What's that one piece of advice?
Don't think that you can do it alone.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Just, you know, at the beginning, you may think you can, and you may, you know. But at some point, my earphone is falling out. But at some point, you know, you're just going to have to put all those moving parts into place.
Well, which is why I'm glad you wrote in the, you know, that part of the boundaries, and don't be afraid to ask for help when you need help. It's not a sign of weakness. It's a sign of strength, actually.
And wisdom, I think, because you will Absolutely. Be, you will be overwhelmed and feel stressed out, and you're not going to be able to do your job as well. And things might fall to the wayside or fall through the cracks and all that. Yeah, and you're not good at everything, right? You're not good at everything. Nobody's good at everything.
nobody's perfect, but that's correct. And this is a major challenge for so many people. So thank you. Ellen Ritberg, the author of Why Is Grandma Naked? Caring for Your Aging Parents. You can go get it if you choose to go to a bookstore, but more likely you can go to the great God Amazon and push a button and it'll be there.
Or my website. And thank you so much, Rabbi, for having me, because I really,
tell everybody your website.
Okay. My website is Ellen Ritberg, and my last name is spelled R as in Ralph, I-T-T, B as in boy, E as in elephant, R, G as in George, first name Ellen.
And E-L-L-E-N.
But my pen name, which is on the book, but I don't, you know, here it is, Ellen Pober Ritberg. I don't know if you can see, but I have trouble pronouncing my own name, but that's part of my comical bent. I can point that out. It's a hard to pronounce name.
No. I am just a tri-address, and nobody believes me. And maybe get a new set of earphones.
Thank you, Rabbi. Thank you so much. I think it's my very small ear canals. They're like abnormally small. Thank you so much for having me.
Good luck with the book. Stay healthy. Stay safe. Thank all of you for, again, being with us on today's edition of Seekers of Meaning, the TV show and podcast arm of Jewish Sacred Aging. Again, we're on the Roku streaming network as well, and we welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email me at rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com. If you'd like to make a tax-free donation to help support the work of the podcast and Jewish Sacred Aging, go to the website, jewishsacredaging.com. Click on the conveniently located donate button. Seekers of Meaning is produced at the Broadcast Center of Lubetkin Media Companies in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And again, our shout out to the genius producer, Steve Lubetkin. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address, and I look forward to greeting you on our next Seekers of Meaning TV show and podcast. In the meantime, stay safe, everybody. Stay healthy. Shalom.